During the Matins this morning, I was struck by the way in which St. Paul said much of what I want to say, or maybe better put, what St. Paul said, I'm going to try to say in other words. And I'd like to reread that passage. I've been rereading it since Matins, and I read it from the new lectionary. I've already been aware of the fact that people were protesting the Matins because of the language. You know, it's very strange, an aside, that language protest gets in the way of meaning so much of the time. But this is from the new lectionary. And I think the older I get, the more I become influenced, not by all the highfalutin stuff I've studied, but by something like this. Something like this. And my wife and I have taken to reading the Bible together, and whenever we can squeeze time. And what a great gift it is. If I speak in human tongues or the tongues of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic answers or prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, I've gone to all kinds of universities and all kinds of conferences and study sessions, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, all kinds of faith, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, deliver my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful. It is not arrogant or rude. Love does not insist on its own way. Try that for kids. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrong. It does not rejoice at wrong, but rejoices in the right. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For our knowledge is imperfect, and our prophecy is imperfect. But when the perfect comes, the imperfect will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult. When I became an adult, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall understand fully, even as I have been fully understood. So faith, hope, love abide, these three. But the greatest of these is love. And as I read that this morning, I pinned this prayer right at the bottom. God grant that I am at least on my way to becoming an adult. On my way. And I hope really that you can remember during this discussion that that's the way I feel. That I'm on my way. So, let me just say it to begin with, this is not, I'm not really getting into this on the basis of the pacifist discussion of nonviolence, and I've been involved in all kinds of discussions with pacifists over the years, and I've always opposed the pacifists because I didn't see how you could get any principle of action, any form of action, anything you should always do, and I always illustrated by thou shalt not lie. And then the French family is hiding Jews. And the German soldiers come. and they ask them if they're hiding Jews, are there any Jews in their house? These are good Catholic Christians, and they say no. No. Or thou shalt not kill. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer, one of the great heroes of my existence, participated in a plot to kill Hitler. Thou shalt not kill. I cannot absolutize, actually I can't absolutize any pattern of action. I think God asks us to do, there are lots of guides. The law is a lot of a guide, but it doesn't tell us what to do ever. Now I want to really come out of my situation. This is a very existential situation. I developed all of this concern recently in response to where I am in my work with people. And I'm trying to understand the different ways in which the people I work with approach life generally and approach negotiation with the Ford Motor Company in particular, which we're involved in now. And then my work on Central America in trying to understand the differences in the approach to the issues. And they are very radical. I might say in that regard that for 6 years we had a seminar centered around the University of Chicago and the Lutheran Seminary and Chicago Theological Seminary with Phil Hefner, some of you may know Phil Hefner, Robert Benny, Franklin Sherman, Whiting Schrader, Gibson Winter, and myself. There were some other people, but and we agreed to disagree after 6 years. Everybody sophisticated, everybody had all kinds of theological, philosophical, sociological, political, economic training, and we disagreed. Very serious, basic directions for American society. We disagreed. So I have no illusions about having the truth. It's not because other people don't have information. It isn't because we have different information that we differ. It's a mystery. It's a complete mystery to me why we do what we do and why we take the positions we do and why we get so really hot and bothered about other people's positions with whom we disagree. I spent a lot of time with the history of thought, and one of the most intelligent men I've ever met or heard about or read about took the history of philosophy and illustrated how the history of philosophy was a history of misunderstanding. That everybody was taking each other apart and not understanding the other person. So I think if there's anything I want to focus upon, it's the listening and the communication and the effort to penetrate to the depths of other people's positions and to have that holy dialogue. Well, I exist in a situation in which I now describe a number of people with whom I work as violent. Violent people. As having a violent way of being. A violent way of looking at life. And this is actually from the notes that I wrote of a meeting we had with black ministers in which I presented this as an effort to help them understand the different grounds on which you might approach negotiation. And what I call a violent approach, in the beginning, before anybody says a word, no communication is taking place. One questions the motives of the people with whom one is going to talk or deal. One assumes from the very beginning that the other is evil, self-centered. Self-centered isn't strong enough. The other is simply seeking his or her own interests and will do anything to get them. And anything to prevent you from getting what you want, unless it coincides with what he or she wants. And by implication, of course, the other is evil and I'm good. People don't say that. But they do say the other is evil. But they don't say I'm good. That's a little more difficult to say. Now, the nonviolent approach, from the very beginning, one assumes that the other is not all evil, that at least the other is a mixture of motives, as good a mixture as you are yourself. You assume that. And if you come out of the scripture, you say, with Jesus, no one is good. With Jesus, no one is good save God. No one is good. So in this Corinthian passage, you're not arrogant. You're not arrogant. You somehow don't begin with the assumption that you are much better than other people. But some people with whom I work assume that everybody else, even their colleagues, including me, of course. And that's where it gets tough. It gets tough when you're working in that kind of situation. And I'm assuming that situation is not uncommon in corporate America or in church life or in I know it's in educational institutions, having spent 39 years there at the University of Chicago. One begins by assuming that confrontation will be necessary. No point in real communication, discussion, negotiation, no point in negotiation. Confrontation is necessary. The only way to achieve desirable results is to threaten to destroy the other. At least take away something very important to the other. There's no way to get agreement on a common program with the people you're dealing with. Now, in the nonviolent approach, one begins by appealing to the better self of the other. The better self of the other. To his interest in justice and fairness. To his or her concern for life in general. I remember back in the 60s, we were negotiating with Jewel Tea Company. I helped start Jesse's organization. Sarah's brother, my wife's brother, worked with him 7 years. I worked with him 5 years. Sarah, 2 years. We were very much a part of it. And the president of Jewel Tea came back from Japan. He said, I came back from Japan because I'm a deacon in a church and I believe in justice. And Jesse looked at me and winked. Well, I don't know quite what the wink meant, because we had the capacity to shut down some of the Jewel stores so people wouldn't go to them. In a middle-class area, you could do that. But the fact that he was a deacon in a church meant a great deal to me. That down deep, he wanted to do justly. And he actually would welcome us coming in to help him do justly, because we would give him the power in the face of some other people who weren't interested in justice to do justly, because we would threaten the economic welfare of the company, and then he could use an economic argument in order to do what he wanted to do. Now, that's my assumption in the situation, is that when a person says he's a deacon of the church and that makes some difference, I take that person seriously. I don't take that just as rhetoric. In the violent way, one assumes that the only strong motive to which one can appeal is fear. I find myself doing that with my son frequently. I'll say, I will take away your 50 cents for ice cream after supper if you don't behave in Vespers. I'm going to take something away. I don't frequently, for some reason, I don't sit down and talk to him about it way ahead of time. And then the event occurs, and he's slouching all over, showing me his watch, what time it is, or something, and I just am beside myself. And so I use that appeal as over against what I'd say a nonviolent approach would assume that while love is care, as a motive, may be warped on that his own interests and relations to what is going on may be, you know, quite distant or not developed. But down deep there is a motive and a care in the other person. And given the right conditions, love will express itself. Given the right conditions. given the right conditions. And I've seen it happen in our own negotiations and in dealing with people. I never got along with my mother after I was old enough to have a mind of my own. And I'd always just argue with her and try to attack her position. And I, you know, as an educated person, had a lot more knowledge and a lot more truth. And then I think she was probably about 65 when I discovered that if I used the non-directive Ruggierian approach, accepted what she said, took it seriously, assumed she had a right to have a different opinion from mine, we got along great. We had the greatest time the next 4 or 5 years after I started learning. It's unbelievable. And up to that point, I assumed she was not too educated, and she wasn't. Not too up on things, and she wasn't. Not too interested in a lot of stuff. But she had ideas and opinions, and she was anti-Catholic and anti-black, and boy, that got me. I couldn't tell you. But, you know, after a while, we could have a rational discussion because I started with another assumption that I didn't have all the truth and I didn't have to oppose all her ideas, and that there was a real possibility for communication. Now, in the violent approach, one assumes that destructive action, so-called evil, must be responded to by an equal or stronger destructive or forceful action, an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. That's the way you've got to respond in life. And if you don't respond, you are going to get stepped on, whether it's in a family or anywhere. And the past then becomes the determination of the future, because you're always responding to what someone has done to you in the past. And that just rankles inside of you, and you want to get even.
Could you say that again? Did you say path or past?
Past. P-A-S-T.
Thank you.
Past.
The past then.
If somebody's done you dirt, then you got to get...
It's getting even.
You got to get even with that person somewhere or other. Recently, a person with whom I work very closely told another person with whom I work very closely not to listen to me, not to meet with me, not to talk to me. And I promptly did a few things for her. I mean, I helped her. I know she said that. And I understand that she's capable of saying that because that's her character. But now in the nonviolent approach, one assumes the destructive action of the past must be absorbed. Absorbed. You know, Jesus went to the cross. He absorbed all that antagonism and fear and anxiety of the people, of the temple and of the leaders, about what he was doing and what he was capable of doing, and so they were out to get him, and he absorbed it. He absorbed it. I'm not sure I want to go to the cross, but in the extreme, that's what it means. You do not respond in kind. One tries to overcome the past, not to forget the past, but to overcome the functioning of the past in determining what you do. You forgive. 70 times 7. My son flunked out of Overland twice. I think he has a signal distinction. Nobody, I think, in the history of Overland ever flunked out twice. I can't imagine anybody flunking out twice. What do? I mean, that's his life. That's what he decided to do. And so you forget it. You treat him as if he didn't flunk out twice. You treat him like you would as if that just wasn't a part of his existence. If you let that get you, boy. And some of the people in our family could not forget it, and it just destroyed the whole relationship.
What did he flunk out of?
Oberlin College.
Oh.
Oh, my, My kids, all the kids from my first family went to Oakland to begin with. Two of them graduated, two of them didn't. And everything has worked out almost too well for my kids. I can't believe it. I don't believe it. But at any rate, they had to go through a lot of counseling and stuff for years, some of them, to get rid of their parents. But, they finally got rid of them, I think. I got rid of our destructiveness, our violence, if you will, to them. I think, who knows, life is such a mystery. I certainly can't explain myself at all, except the Methodist hymns on which I grew up in Eppert's League. I think they had a great influence on me. Having monopoly on truth and virtue, when there's a tendency to assume one has all the answers in the violent approach, all the truth, and that other people are stupid, they're idiots. I've heard more people say other people are stupid and idiots. Now, if you think other people are stupid and idiots, it's almost everybody that you talk about, it's obvious that you think you're smart. Pride of knowledge. That's why this passage in Corinthians, it hits all these things in there. It's just amazing. I'm so amazed. I shouldn't be amazed, but I've read this thing, heard it how many times? Maybe 500 times, would you say? We've all heard that passage from 1 Corinthians 57, I think it is. Here it is. For our knowledge is imperfect. That's what it says. I'm sure some people don't really believe their knowledge is imperfect. At least it doesn't seem to me they do from the way they treat others. And I'm treated as a boy without knowledge or experience. And I have had all kinds of knowledge thrust on me and all kinds of experience. I organized King's campaign when he was in Chicago, and I ran all the logistics for it. Gosh, spent all these years with Jesse negotiating and working. Went to Central America with him recently on his trip. He's had a lot of experience. Then when people treat you that way, of course you don't have all the knowledge, but when it's obvious that you've had a lot of knowledge and experience and you get treated as if you have none, something is wrong, I think. And I try to explain it by this nonviolent versus violence. Now, in the violent way, one becomes bitter. And you want to punish others with our children. You want to punish them. It gets to the place where you hate people. Merton says, Thomas Merton, Catholic monk, nonviolent person, says that hell is where the only thing people have in common is that they hate each other. And I had themselves. Because all our modern psychology certainly tends to teach you that if you hate other people, there's something about the way you look at yourself that's rooted in some way, that you can't love yourself if you don't love somebody else. If you loved yourself, you would almost automatically love someone else. Now, in the nonviolent approach, one assumes that the truth is won in a process of listening to others. Extended communication, our knowledge is imperfect. One starts with the ambiguities of life, the mixture of truth and untruth, of virtue and of vice. That notion of ambiguity has saved my life so many times. I can't do all the things right that I should, and I never will, and if I do one thing, I won't do another, and I'm a mixture of envy and truth and untruth and vice and virtue, and so I better live with it and accept it, or I'll certainly have to distort everything in order to appear to my child to have all the knowledge and all the virtue. And I frequently will say to have said, I'm wrong. I was wrong. I hit you. I don't often hit, but every once in a while. I think I hit Paul, my present son, once, but before I was under great pressure in a situation. I was flunking, just flunking the situation. And I had headaches on the weekends, and you know, everything. And when you get that way, everything goes in your family life. It's your problem, but you blame everybody else for the things that don't go right. You get mighty tense. If you don't believe you're justified by grace, you have all kinds of problems in life, I think. And you become violent. It's the way you take out your own sense of inadequacy on other people. Now, I think there's assumption in the violent way of life. And this, mind you, this is just the last 6 months I've worked out this stuff. In the violent way, the assumption is that we are isolated individuals or unrelated social units so that if I win, you lose. If you win, I lose. We're in a war of all against all, according to Thomas Hobbes. And all we have are individuals seeking their own power. And so, if other people get in the way of you getting your power, you got to destroy them. Destroy the individual. Destroy the individual. Now, in the nonviolent way, when it begins with assumption that we are all parts of each other, and that's the other passage that's meant so much to us, and out of which we formed our intentional Christian community with 60 people out of our church. Some now aren't members of the church, but the heart of it is our local church. If you lose, I lose. If you win, I win. It's a win-win. I mean, you've heard that stuff in business now. I mean, you've got to develop situations where they're win-win situations. And Vice President Ford, in charge of employee relations, he said, I know you, we got to have a win-win situation. You've got to win. In this negotiation with the black community. You got to win, we got to win. I know that. Now, some of the people with whom I work don't believe him. They don't believe that he functions that way. They see him as a hard negotiator, the lawyer with whom we work, and say, you guys don't have enough knowledge and experience with hard, you know, the tough negotiators from corporate America. They are going to take you for a ride. And the chairman, the ministers, the chairman of the negotiating team, and myself, and the new president of PUSH, for whom I'm the assistant in charge of this economic development, said, no, let's take them at their word. Let's work cooperatively. If things don't work out, we can do something. But to begin with the notion that the only way you can work is to try to destroy the other or threaten the other, the whole language is different. It is unbelievable how different the approaches are. And so I'm called naive. Just the other day, one of my co-workers called me naive. I said, I don't think I'm naive. I may be optimistic, but I'm not naive. I haven't gone through a lot of tough situations and a lot of power plays and experience in the last votes at the Divinity School of the University of Chicago were 18-2 and 17-3. And you know where I was. And with the 2 or 3, I didn't have the power in that situation. And they were votes, in my judgment, which were sellouts to the whole consumption way. You get students there to get your budget. That's what you do. Get them there, and you have a program that will keep them there a couple, 3 years, and then you can get rid of them, and in the meantime, you got your budget. And what happens to them? You know, dog eat dog, they win their way, or they don't win their way. Now, Carl Rogers said, if you take a PhD student, you have an obligation as a faculty to see that student gets his PhD. Now, that's a wholly different view of the way you work with people. At any rate, that's the, there's some other things I could say. I've been working recently on Martin Luther King's philosophy. He believes, of course, that God is on the side of love. and not on the side of hate, and that those who love in some way or other will be justified, or their names will be written in heaven, and those who hate won't. But I'm not really trying to get into that. I'm really trying to come out of my experience and then to apply it to the U.S.-USSR relations, which is the other situation which is so fraught with difficulty and division within the country. You know, House voted 221 to 209. There's obviously a great division in the country on the issues of foreign policy with respect to Central America or many other things, nuclear weapons. And you can't assume that to be a Christian puts you on one side or the other. Saturday I'm going to talk about socialism and capitalism and Christianity. If you think today is a problem, well, I get into that. At any rate, this is the way I, and this all has been worked out in the last week, this stuff, this on USSR, because I do feel that the next 25 years will be determined by the relationship of US and USSR. The future of what happens in the world is determined by the way we relate to the USSR. A lot of other important things going on, a lot of other realities. We don't know what China will become 25 years from now. She may be the great empire. There are two empires in the world. That's what there are. There are two great, Babylonia, Assyria. You can go back in the Old Testament. And in many ways, as I preach sermons on, the USSR is the same as Assyria in a way. Trying to understand how you can see the rise of an empire like that as having a function in the history of the world, saying something to us, trying to make some positive. Well, anyway, here we go. In the violent approach to the USSR, the leaders of the USSR are thugs. And in the nonviolent approach, they're persons more or less like us. Some bad, some good, some worse. Some betray their country, some betray their principles in USSR, like some of our presidents betray our principles. But it's a mixture. And what I could say, I think, is that they are as serious about life as we are. In a nonviolent approach, other people are serious. They're just not operators. And we're not just serious. We're operators for our own benefits with all kinds of prejudices and all kinds of power plays going on, all kinds of hidden agendas going on in both countries. Well, if you've got an enemy who have no morals, just thugs, just interested in their own way of life and in controlling all the rest of the world for their purposes, without regard to humanity in any of us, if that's the way you interpret the other, then you must confront with the threat and the power to destroy the other. If the other is that bad, now, if you do have a Hitler, and you got to make a judgment whether you got a Hitler, if you do have a Hitler, you got to destroy him. So it's a matter of judgment as to whether you have a Hitler or you have people more or less like you who are serving what they consider to be the national interests of another country. Now, the nonviolent approach assumes that they care about their people and the future of the world. That they care about them, that they're human beings, that they're children of God. Now, to be sure, here and there you're going to get an aberration like Hitler. I don't know about Gaddafi to know what kind of an aberration he might be. But generally speaking, the nonviolent will assume that just because they have a different way of organizing their society and a different understanding of life, they are not demons. They're children of God. The violent approach assumes that only the fear of destruction is a useful motive. So that there's no way to negotiate, no way to appeal to their better interests, no way to have a kind of mutuality of program, no way to come out of their view and our view and have common action. I spent my life trying to understand the differences between ways of looking at life and how out of different ways you can get common action. I couldn't sell a divinity school on that. They believe that because you had to have an agreement, theological agreement, in order to act together, and you couldn't get that. You can't get agreement in a church theologically, I mean on every jot and tittle. If you did, you'd never get any action. So therefore, they would act politically. They would never try to make an assessment of how from different theological positions you could get some common action and a common curriculum. So everybody battled for a section of the curriculum, but there was no unity to the curriculum. The curriculum didn't make any sense. It was just everybody got a little piece. And that's somehow the way it goes with violent people who look at the world as dog eat dog. You give each a little piece, but the common good is never thought of. You don't assume there's any way to act out of different perspectives together. So you never discuss it. And in many ways, that's our political system. We just let one force balance the other. And there's some advantages to that, as over against the British or the French, where the party has to have a program, and because then it's difficult to get enough people for any program. So then you have to have all these coalitions. But anyway, I'm just trying to illustrate that this stuff is relevant and useful, I think, in political theory and in political organizations.
Alex, excuse me, can I interrupt?
Sure, go ahead.
Question. In most of the negotiations that you're aware of, what kind of approach do most of our negotiators take?
I think it depends upon who's in power. I mean, if you take a Kissinger, whoever is Secretary of State sets the tone. Dulles set a tone. He was so anti-communist and he was violent, I think. Dulles was violent. Good Christian violence. Because of his interpretation of reality. Now, some of our other Secretaries of State were much more open. And sometimes they'd shift their positions. My memory is really failing in my old age, but there was another leader who was our ambassador to Russia for a long time, 6 years or so. He's written a book on this, The Nuclear Delusion, or something
George,
like that.
George Kennan.
Now, George Kennan took, if you read The Nuclear Delusion, and we studied it in our church group, you get quite a different point of view toward that reality. So it depends upon the leadership, I think. There's no uniformity, and there's a fight all the time within our political parties for which approach, in general. I don't say you've got absolutes in this, but the movement toward one or the other of these approaches is embodied in people, and they fight for power and position, and they fight within the administration right now over this. Now, I don't know the detail because I'm not inside, but I can tell you the detail inside a push, and that's where I can see how it works out and how it depends on who gets the power. It depends on who's on the committee. It depends upon who goes to a meeting, what kind of thrust. If you get certain people in a meeting, in fact, our president excluded some people who were violent from the meetings because he thought it would destroy the other approach. So they were actually excluded. Probably wrong, because now they've really come back and try to chop our heads off by all kinds of maneuvers because they think their position. I suspect that that's what goes on nationally, but I don't know enough. I've never been inside the government. Now, the nonviolent approach assumes that one should not try to destroy the other, but one should try to help the other build life, life of opportunity, food, shelter, work. And the desire to build that is a strong motive on the part of the other, and should be on the part of us. That is, rather than destroying the other, we should look at our international relations, our foreign relations, as an opportunity to build the life of opportunity, even with the enemy, even in Russia. We should find ways. It's like I tried to help this person who's violent toward me. We have to do everything we can. It's the nonviolent approach. You do everything you can for the person you consider, for some reason, is out to destroy you, to help that person. Not to destroy you, but to help that person do things that are important for that nation to be done. Of course, you get into all kinds of things now, because war is total. As Sarah was trying to say yesterday, war is total. Everything is done and used. Non-military aid is very ambiguous. Very selective in using the past from a nonviolent point of view. The nonviolent people would look at Russia, 20 million people killed, prevented many of us from being killed because they entered the war against Hitler. After the revolution, we helped invade Russia, and they have that history and that concern we will do the same, so they're suspicious of us. And we emphasize, of course, Stalin in Russia, and not Gorbachev. I recently bought a book of Gorbachev. You don't know from rhetoric what a person is like, but you don't have much else, in some cases, to read it. I want to know what he was saying, at least. And I think, where are we going in time? I've got to stop here. Complete distrust, all vice on the part of the other. They are out to conquer the world, sink us. That's the only interpretation. There's no fight going on within their country like there is in ours, and I think that's false. We have the truth about life, social organization, about the only workable system in the world. There's no real problems here. I mean, this is the line you get, is over against recognizing I live with the underclass every day. That's where our potential community is. And 20% of the people in this country their lives are so bleak. There's nothing in their lives. Nothing. I ran a building with 21 units and about 30 people. Four people died of alcoholism.
You're saying that 48 million people in this country, that's approximately 20%.
Yeah.
48 million.
Fairly bleak lives without much future. They don't have much spirit. Let me put it this way.
You're talking about greater than the whole population of Central America. All the countries combined in Central America, south of Mexico, north of Colombia. In this country, their lives are so bleak.
They're very bleak. Very little possibility for the future. I mean, there's a size. I may be wrong. Maybe it's 18%. Maybe it's 15%. There's a sizable proportion that way. I purposefully placed myself with this group of people in order to understand nothing that's happened in the last 50 years by any administration, anything, has helped the people of Woodlawn, where I live. Nothing. It's kept them afloat. But nothing really has been creative and helpful. Buildings go down. Good buildings go down. Every couple of weeks, another building goes down. Good buildings. We took an abandoned building, half rate, half the stuff was out of it. All the stuff was out of it in some places. You know, they took the woodwork. They took every single thing except the plaster. We took the plaster down and thought we were going to get some money to redo it. So it stayed there in this one section for 7 years. But know, people throw bottles out of the windows of the apartments near us, and they hit our storm windows, and there's this culture there that's so destructive. And there are just these pockets all over. It's on the west side, it's the same, and it's in Oakland. We're in Woodlawn, Oakland is the same. West side, Lawndale is the same in Chicago. And a recent book out on it is The New Urban Reality by sophisticated urbane students, University of Chicago students and others, depicting the growing collection of black and Hispanic individuals in this plight in our northern cities. Our northern cities are degenerating in the snow belt, as northeastern and midwestern cities. Anyway, it's a bleak picture. You got to admit that. You know, I don't say that it tells us what to do. It just raises a question about what we are doing, because I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. We got a few little things going. We're training a few black carpenters and buying buildings and doing all kinds of stuff, but it's a business. Now, the nonviolent would say Afghanistan was a tragedy, but it's at least near their turf. Vietnam, we were near their turf, we surround them, and we gotta at least take that into account. We don't want them on our turf, they don't want us near their turf, but we don't apply the same principles. With all the bases we have and the nuclear weapons surrounded them, the nonviolent approach would say they got reasons to be antsy, particularly with the rhetoric against them. Nicaragua is the same as Afghanistan. Who's a terrorist? You know, the Russians are the terrorists in Afghanistan, and the Sandinistas are the terrorists in Nicaragua. There are many problems in dealing with this, but perhaps I should stop. I've got. Violent rhetoric is necessary to convince the people of the danger, and the nonviolence would say violence begets more violence. If you use violent rhetoric, you're going to create violent people. It escalates from rhetoric to action. And in the violent approach, if you're not for destroying the USSR, you are a communist in disguise. If you really set out the nonviolent approach to destroy the USSR, you will destroy the world. To attempt to make us superior, which is my interpretation of the direction we're moving, will bankrupt both nations. And the arms race that results, there'll be no winner. All the people will lose. But these are only judgments that I've made. I might change my mind tomorrow or the next day or 5 years from now, to right now, I've come down on this nonviolent approach, and that's the way I operate. So, thank you. Hope to be here. Questions or whatever you.
Well, to change the direction in which things are going nationally, then we almost have to have leaders who are of the nonviolent point of view. And that to me seems almost impossible in the current situation to have anyone like that chosen for office. I mean, they don't rise to the forefront anyway, you know. I haven't heard anybody espousing this point of view for a long time.
Well, Jesse Jackson does, but because he's black, he, for me, obviously, he's the most capable from the point of view of this perception of reality. Most coincides with mine, to me, that way. But he had no choice. I'm not sure I'd want him for president anyway. But his perceptions and his understandings, to my mind, are the most real and relevant and perceptive.
But what's really behind this, going to these different areas and trying to resolve some situations that we've done? In other words, he makes issue, just like the down flyer, and he goes over there and gets some free net. What's really behind all that?
Well, probably a lot of things. Probably it puts him in the limelight, and he can make his speeches about all kinds of stuff, and people listen to him because he's done something like that. Partly he's, we respond, you can't believe what we respond to at Bush. We respond to everybody's problem all over the lot in Chicago, because that's where our headquarters are. And it's just, you know, you respond. Somebody dies, you go. It becomes a push, frequently a push funeral or something. And you simply respond to people's needs. And the other, I think, is to get relationships. In other words, he really believes in communication. I made several speeches after the Central American trip, and I developed the principles of nonviolence that he applied in that trip. That's going, listening, hearing, getting information, direct information, for whatever, you know, whatever you say that means, establishing relations, not treating the other as an ogre, but trying to understand. Actually, Castro in the church, first time in 10 years, they said, when we were there, he came to church, and he's now written a book on it. And I mean, I don't know what happened, but Jesse is, he's going into all these high schools. You probably heard of it. One of my granddaughters said that she was in Washington as a page for one of the congresspersons, and so she wasn't there when he came to Phoenix. But she said when she got back, that was in January, when she got back in June, they were still talking about it. These kids stand up and tell them, we're on dope, we're on alcohol. I mean, why does he do it? Because he really believes that you got to take care of yourself first. If you don't take care of yourself, if you let yourself be destroyed, there's no hope for anything. It'd just be destroyed people. And it's really an epidemic, I think, with dope and alcoholism among teenagers and others. So why does he do it? I think he's both political and a do-gooder. He's a do-gooder. I see a lot of myself. He's more political than I am, I think. I'm a do-gooder. I just like to do something for somebody. If anybody comes pushing to ask me to do something, I'll do it. And they get on me all the time because I'll do it. And it doesn't always fit into the program. And he's that way.
Yeah. How essential to the nonviolent approach is the assumption, one of the assumptions you made, that we are all parts of one another. And you tie that to the possibility and the viability of a win-win.
It was essential for Gandhi. You read his stuff, it's all the way through. It is essential, according to Merton, in his interpretation of Gandhi and nonviolence. It's essential for King that we begin with God. And under God, we are all parts of each other because we belong to God. Not that we have become parts sociologically or in terms of our experience, but we are parts. A very hard concept in some ways to accept, but I accept it, I believe it, I try to live out of it.
Now, I understand that you believe it. I'm trying to figure out, it's very foreign from my upbringing in Scripture, the concept that not just the body of Christ, but every human being of any nationality, whether they are atheists or not, I should grieve when they grieve, I should, we are all...
You say it's foreign? It's foreign?
It's totally foreign.
How can you love God whom you have not seen if you don't love the brother whom you have seen? I mean, there's so many parts of Scripture that would put all humanity, all the creation, even nature groaneth in Romans for salvation. There are not too many passages like that, but they're certainly there. I admit, a lot of Christianity has had a vertical relationship and it's an individual relationship with God, and the horizontal dimension is de-emphasized. But if you take Paul seriously, in the Habits of the Heart, they quote John Winthrop. I haven't got it here. But John Winthrop, a Puritan, and he came out of the same image. In the Puritans came out of it. I'd say there's a difference in the way we appropriate the scripture. And think about our relation to God. And I don't know what you do. I'll expand the problem and get into some complexities for me as to whether there's any salvation outside the church. And outside the church, in some sense, being saved as a church. That is to say, we are saved together. Now that's a very difficult notion, and I think that notion really runs counter to much of it. We think individuals are saved, and it's an individual matter. And I don't know how much that's a result of the individualism of our culture. I think partly it is. Our whole culture is individualistic. In the Habits of the Heart, they say, we have an ontological individualism in this country. The only real thing is the individual. Only real thing is the individual. And a Christian would say, in relation to God. I've argued for a long time that individualism is crucial, and yet if moved to the extreme, will destroy us.